Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This verdict is a reaffirmation that this nation's judicial system is the greatest ever devised.
Defense attorney Peter Quijano likes the outcome, and you might say there's a lot to like and a lot not to like about last night's verdict in the Ahmed Gadlani trial. The 36-year-old defendant in the bombing of the U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania is now officially a convicted terrorist and likely to spend the rest of his life in prison. The first Gitmo detainee tried and the first found guilty in a civilian U.S. court. The trial was held here in New York without incident or disruption. He was convicted even though some crucial evidence was excluded because of the coercive interrogation techniques used after his capture. Justice was served, as the attorney was just saying there, by an honest jury, apparently willing to acquit on most charges, even in a terror trial, even in New York, if that's where the evidence led. But did the government win enough of its case? Well, conventional wisdom in the media this morning is saying no, because he was also acquitted of 284 out of the 285 charges against him. And if you're wondering why that was the number, it had a lot to do with the number of people killed, which was 224 people, including 12 Americans, in those simultaneous or almost simultaneous same-day embassy attacks. So this verdict may make it harder for the Obama administration to try Khalid Sheikh Mohammed here on 9/11 charges and other terrorism trials as well. What are the lessons of the Gailani verdict for New York, for Washington, for Africa, for al-Qaeda? Let's talk to Karen Greenberg, director of the Center for Law and Security at NYU. Professor, welcome back to WNYC. And listeners, we will take your calls, and we have a poll on our politics website. Was justice served in the Gailani case, and how does the outcome affect your feelings about other civilian terror trials or having them in New York? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or respond to the poll on our politics website. It's afreecountry.org, but we will take your phone calls right now on your reaction to any piece of this, 212-433-9692. Karen, are you surprised by the verdict?
Stunned.
Really?
And I think everyone in the courtroom was.
Really?
Yes. The prosecutors and the defense attorney had the equivalent looks of shock on their faces, and for good reason. We do not hear the word not guilty ever uttered in a terrorism trial. We've had hundreds of them, some of them very high profile, since 9/11, and it's just not an option.
So break it down for us as best you can. It looks to me, for one thing, like he was convicted of conspiracy to destroy property at the embassies in Kenya, Tanzania in 1998, but not to kill the hundreds of people who died in the attack. Am I reading it right?
Essentially, that's
they made
correct.
The distinction between a conspiracy to destroy the property and a conspiracy to commit murder. How could the evidence have led them to that distinction?
Because there was very, very little, if any, evidence in this trial. In fact, I can't think of any that wasn't circumstantial. So possibly what they did was just pick what seemed like the least of the charges. There was never any evidence presented that Gailani knew about what the conspiracy was, that he had any feelings about or thoughts about the ideology that is associated with jihad and al-Qaeda. And the one other factor that nobody really talks about, but I want to mention, is that Mr. Gailani was in the courtroom for the entire trial, something we hadn't quite expected because he had asked not to be in the courtroom. And his presence, I think, made a big difference to the jury and to actually everyone there, because he is a very, I don't know how to say this, but he is a very mild person who conveyed a sense of just non-threateningness that was pervasive. And
The Times mentioned today that he smiled frequently with his attorneys.
He had a very shy affect and a very shy smile. And I would say it was a team that cared about each other. You don't see this in very few criminal cases, let alone terrorism cases. There was a personal rapport. And they felt deeply about him, and he felt deeply about them. And there was no hiding it. It was genuine, and it was pervasive, and it was there from pre-trial hearings all the way through to the end.
Alex in Flushing, you're on WNYC. Alex, thanks for calling in.
Thanks, Brian. I think what's getting people very disturbed about this is that there was evidence that was available that was there, that was deemed inadmissible. And in a military tribunal, it probably wouldn't have been deemed inadmissible. And what's more than that is that that evidence was not exculpatory. It was definitely something that would have been used to convict this person and definitely made to look as if basically this person did something and that now he's not going to be convicted of it because of a combination of rules and poor actions by the initial, people who arrested him, quote-unquote.
Yes. Alex, thank you. I think he makes an important point, Professor. The fact that he was subjected to harsh interrogation when he was captured, or what many people call torture, wound up mattering to the case, correct?
You know, I'm not so sure. Yes, it mattered in that witness was not allowed to testify in the trial, but the witness did come to New York, and the witness was put on the stand in a pretrial hearing, which I attended, and which was quite extensive and long. And yes, the problem was that he was the fruit of Gailani being tortured, and there was no other way they could have found him. But there was a further problem that arose during that testimony, and that was the role of the Tanzanian National Police. And there was a suspicion that he had, that whatever he was saying because he was afraid of them. And this would have come out much more strongly in court. The role of the Tanzanian National Police was a problem throughout this trial. They were the original interpreters. There were none other than the police on the original reports that the FBI had. So we don't really know what was said, and there was a lot of a discrepancy between what was originally said to the FBI and what was said later. The Tanzanian National Police accompanied the witnesses, not just that one, but all of the Tanzanian witnesses to New York when they came here. They stayed with them overnight in the hotel, and there was just a very uncomfortable sense throughout that we didn't really know why people were saying what they were saying and how to credit it, and it would have been much more powerful in the case of this one other person as it was when he was there. So that's the first thing, and I think that's just something you have to consider.
So the evidence that this excluded witness would have presented, you think, would have tied this person more directly to the murders and not just to the conspiracy to destroy property?
Not necessarily, because he was not a credible witness. He might not have come across as a credible witness, because any time he was asked about was he afraid of being not sent back home by the Tanzanian National Police, he might have said yes. There was a sense that he, we didn't know how threatened he felt or not, but it was there. So it was. We don't really know what he would have said or how it would have stood up on cross-examination, and certainly not in front of a jury who would have been attuned to that right away.
Daoud and Patterson, you're on WNYC. Thank you for calling.
Daoud. Hi, Brian. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you. Go ahead.
Listen, my comment has to do with the fact that until we have the people in Guantanamo and allow them to have their day in court, we're going to have this cloud hanging over us, because we're supposed to be the land of law, the land of true freedom. And if the people don't get their day in court and be charged and tried, and whether they're guilty or whether they're innocent, we're going to have problems. So I'm very happy this trial went through. I'm not really concerned about who's guilty or not guilty, because if you break the law, you have to be held accountable.
Why not consider them prisoners of war, Daoud?
Again, that's another problem, because basically it appears, and I don't have all the information, but it appears what we're doing is we're making the rules up as we go along. If you have a war, I mean, I was thinking the other day, what about when we were in World War II? Weren't there Japanese and German people that were made prisoners of war? What did we do with them after the war was over? What did we do with them while the war was going on? Why can't we apply those lessons here now?
Daoud, thank you. And Karen Greenberg, I mean, we released them after the war was over, because the war was over, didn't we?
Correct. With prisoners of war, you can either keep, you know, try them for war crimes, or you can hold them to cessation of hostilities and release them. And
that's the argument here, really, is that these are war crimes, right? If they attacked civilians, like at the U.S. Embassy, mostly civilians died, mostly Kenyans and Tanzanians. And so they were not on the battlefield. They were not attacking soldiers. So these are arguably at least, war crimes.
And what you could say is that this is the second piece of the embassy bombings trial. The original trial for the bombings was in 2001, and the four defendants were convicted, and they were tried in a civilian court. And so the premises of this case were established and the legal venue for it a long time ago.
And also because this is the so-called long war, there isn't going to be a resolution like when Germany or Japan are vanquished and the war is over and you release the political prisoner, the prisoners of war. These people are going to be held for the rest of their lives, almost certainly, because al-Qaeda-style terrorism will not be vanquished between now and then.
Right. I mean, that's one point. I think the other point is that, certainly for myself, and I don't know about for other viewers, but this trial, I would have thought there would have been much more evidence against Gailani, not just from that one witness, but I was really surprised by the way to which, however you cut the story, he was peripheral to the narrative. Mm-hmm. And at best. And that surprised me. I wasn't expecting to hear. So I don't know. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is another story, but I don't really know how the other cases will play out.
Karen Greenberg, director of the Center for Law and Security at NYU, as we explore the lessons of the Gailani verdict, guilty on one count of conspiracy, not guilty on 284 other counts, still going to be sentenced to 20 years to life in prison, likely effectively the rest of his life in prison regardless, but political implications for future civilian as opposed to military trials of terrorism detainees, etc. And 212-433-WNYC is our number if you want to join the conversation, 212-433-9692, or answer our poll on itsafreecountry.org, our politics website, on whether justice was served here. itsafreecountry.org. There was the incident earlier this week, Karen, where one juror asked to be dismissed because she saw the case differently from all the others and she felt she was being attacked by her fellow jurors. The jurors are not speaking. Their privacy, considering it was a terrorism trial, is being carefully protected, their anonymity as well. But is it clearer to you from the verdict who was on what side of that conflict?
You know, it makes you want to. Everybody assumed that, you know, the woman who said she was being, you know, attacked
wanted to acquit him.
But then when the decision came down, when you thought about the legal questions they had asked prior to the verdict, they had asked the judge prior to the verdict, it suggests that it was the other way, that the urge for acquittal was very strong and that it was immediate. And that may have something to do with the strength of the closing argument on the part of the man whose comment you played before, Peter Keanu, who was lead defense counsel.
So I wonder if the jury made a kind of internal deal. Find him guilty on something they could justify to themselves that would put him behind bars for probably the rest of his life, but acquit him on everything else to make the point that the prosecution didn't have the goods, you think?
I'm not sure that they had any sense what a sentence would be attached to it. You know, sentencing is kept far away from the jury. It's not their domain.
Right.
But yes, I do think there could have, I mean, we're speculating, but that could have been a deal that they made. It was a weak case as it came out, and it just seemed to get weaker as it went along. And, you know, the first time the FBI did a search of the premises of Mr. Gailani, they didn't find evidence, but they left it empty for 3 days while the Tanzanian National Police could do what they wanted, and then, or anybody else, and then they came in 3 days later and found evidence that they hadn't found before. So that kind of thing, when a jury sees it, is not a slam dunk for sure.
Michelle in Wyckoff, you're on WNYC. Hi, Michelle.
Hi. I wonder why everybody's so surprised. If your analyst is saying there was a weak case, it was presented as a weak case, why is everybody so surprised with the verdict?
Good question, including our analyst.
No, it's such a great question. It lets you know what world we live in. Because I guess my job is to follow terrorism trials. And I have followed hundreds of them, or either pleas or trials, since 9/11. And there are no acquittals. There are four very weak acquittals on people that were picked up the wrong way, et cetera. But on a major case, it's just not something that we thought was acceptable. And, you know, in point of fact, your question points to the the fact that that cases should be about the evidence presented, but it hasn't felt that way necessarily.
Claude in Nassau County, you're on WNYC. Hi, Claude.
Hi, good morning. It just proves that we need to arrest, try, and hang Bush, Cheney, Wu, Addington, Scalia, Roberts, and the rest of the criminal thugs that started the whole torture process. Torture is wrong no matter what, and it doesn't matter who's going to be trying it, because justice can be served by the humans and the individual citizens that this Constitution entrusted with it, not some elitist military junta.
Thank you, Claude. Not mincing words there. You want to talk about the word torture, which you used, Karen, in regard to what was actually done to Gailani when he was interrogated?
Yeah, Gailani was one of the individuals who was kept at a black site where he was interrogated and alleged torture. And
remind us, the term black site means?
The black site means the secret interrogation centers in other countries that CIA took its prisoners in the war on terror to. You know, there's a lot of ways to address this. One would be the way of saying, look, you know, people who criticize this case would have liked some of this evidence that was disallowed because of torture to be in. I'm not sure that would have made a difference, but if you really want all the evidence in the case, you shouldn't torture people. That's point number one.
And what was done to him?
We don't know exactly. We don't know the details. That's classified evidence, but it was presented in pretrial hearings, and so the judge and others know it.
The questioning was all before he was brought to Guantanamo Bay, correct?
Correct.
So it doesn't actually reflect on conditions or treatment at Gitmo?
No.
And yet people are saying this verdict is going to make it harder for the Obama administration to close Gitmo. Do you think so?
I think it's going to make it harder for them to try the rest. They wanted to bring five high-value detainees. Gailani is in that category. He's not like the other people at Guantanamo who may or may not have just been picked up in the wrong place at the wrong time. The 14 high-value detainees were moved there at the end of 2006 by George Bush, and in a way legitimizing the idea that the worst of the worst were there. Gailani is one of those people. So the other five that Eric Holder had announced he would bring to federal court may not be coming here, but I would say that it's not really because of this decision, though it will be blamed on this decision. Last weekend, the Washington Post reported that the administration was just going to keep Khalid Sheikh Mohammed in Guantanamo for the foreseeable future and forego the option for now of a civilian trial. And I think that's right. I think the decision was made before this trial, and it was certainly made after the jury. And this is my guess, after the jury was out for a day or two, because that was seen as just the deliberation process was seen as a risk. They don't want these people to get the benefits of a system of justice.
So before you go, give me your opinion on the $64 million question. Should this serve as a lesson to the federal government on the larger question of when or if to try terrorism suspects, including 9/11 suspects, in civilian court or in New York, because that's where the debate is going to go?
Absolutely, and it should go like this. The courts can do it. This was an easy trial in terms of security. It was an easy trial in terms of confidentiality of the press. It was an easy trial in terms of evidence and the standards of the prosecution and defense being met. And the biggest thing about this trial is that you try people, and if they're guilty, you convict them, and if they're not guilty, you don't convict them. And for both those reasons, the easiness of the trial and the ability to have not guilty and guilty as verdicts, the system works.
Yeah, although we should point out that I think you told us in a previous interview that even if he was completely found not guilty in this case, he was still going to be held as a terrorism detainee. Is that correct?
That was an option that the judge presented on the eve of the trial in an opinion that he wrote. And so it sort of lingered over the trial. And who knows? They could have decided to do that. Nobody's quite gone so far as to turn that into a policy, but you know, they may have known at that point they had a weak case, and that's why they said it.
Karen Greenberg, Director of the Center for Law and Security at NYU, thank you very much for coming on with
us
on this. And we're going to take a few more phone calls on the lessons of the Gailani verdict for New York, for Washington, for Africa, and for Al-Qaeda. And we're clearing a couple of lines right now, and I wonder if there's anybody from Kenya listening right now or anybody from Tanzania who has a reaction to this. The African reaction, the domestic reaction in the countries where this crime actually took place is relevant here. So if you are from Kenya, if you are from Tanzania, how do you feel about this? Do you feel that the American justice system worked? Do you feel that the American justice system will be perceived back home as willing to follow the evidence, even for an accused terrorist, or somehow letting down the victims of this case, the victims of this attack, by letting him off on all the murder charges? 212-433-WNYC. And for the moment, add your voice to the mix only if you are from Kenya or Tanzania. 212-433-9692. If anybody happens to be listening who is from there. James hung up. Okay, James is going to argue. James, you can call back too. James is going to argue that this should not be seen as a war crime. 212-433-WNYC. But Phil in Jacksonville, you're on WNYC. Hello. And Phil's line is not working. Here's Bob in Manhattan, who's an attorney. Hi, Bob.
Hi. Two things. One, in terms of the negative reaction of some of our elected officials, I think Peter King made some comments. It almost, to me, is an insult to this jury. I really second what Ms. Greenberg had to say about that. This is a jury from this area. The courthouse is literally in the shadows of the World Trade Center, and who did what they were supposed to do under the law, not to convict unless the evidence is proven beyond, the case is proven beyond a reasonable doubt. And there's no reason to believe that this jury did not seriously look at all of that evidence. And if you're going to try someone in court, they're going to either be found guilty or not guilty, or there's going to be a hung jury in a civilian court, that is. And it doesn't serve our system of justice to say, well, we're going to take the folks from Guantanamo into civilian court, and it's a victory only if they're convicted. And I think it really is a testament to our system that this happened, and to the jury. The jury here did what they were supposed to do. The second point I wanted to make is about the exclusion of the evidence of the witness whose identity was elicited from torture.
Yes.
The government had every right to appeal that decision. And in fact, in run-of-the-mill criminal cases, they often appeal pretrial rulings of judges. I think the fact that the government did not appeal that decision pre-trial corroborates what your guest was saying, that the government really didn't want to put this person on the stand anyway because his credibility was very, very weak. And it may have ended up hurting their case to have him on the stand, because what a lot of us defense attorneys often welcome is when the government puts on someone on the stand who is in fact very shady. It ends up hurting the government's case. So I think for those reasons they decided not to appeal and to go with the evidence that they had, which was probably from their perspective a good decision.
But then why would they have tried to get this witness on the witness list in the first place if they thought he was going to be weak?
Well, they didn't want to preclude themselves from calling him in the
right.
eventuality of the trial.
Right.
They would have him on the witness list.
But they didn't want to make a big...
The defense made the motion to suppress.
But maybe they didn't want to make a big deal about it on appeal, also because they didn't want more evidence to come out about the nature of the torture.
Yes, and that's certainly possible. And, you know, the fact is that because we don't know the details of the torture, it gives the opportunity for some people like Mr. King to say, oh, you know, this was just a technicality, you know, and I would really beg to differ. You know, torture in our system of justice, you know, evidence elicited from torture is certainly not a technicality.
Bob, thank you very much for your call. We appreciate your attorney's point of view. And we're going to put two callers on together here who are both calling in on the underlying question of whether this should be seen as an act of war or seen as a crime. So we have Howard in Morristown calling in, and also Bill in Manhattan. And let's see how I can get these folks up together. Howard, are you there?
Yes. Good morning, Brian.
And now, Bill, are you there?
Yes, good morning.
Bill, thank you. Howard, go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to say it was just very disingenuous of the last gentleman who spoke to say that Peter King, this was a slap at the jury. The jury, Peter King's point is that this should have been held in a military court where various other pieces of evidence could be could have been presented and presented in a different manner under different rules. It is not a slap at the jury. The jury did what it had to do or should have done under the law. The slap is that this should never have been, these terrorist cases should not be before civilian criminal juries. In criminal court.
Bill?
Civilian criminal court.
Well, I have to say I disagree fervently. As a person who lives 500 feet from the World Trade Center then and now, and as a person who, you know, I view this as criminal activity. It is not done by an organized state. Generally speaking, warfare is an extension of diplomacy. There is no element of diplomatic process before, during, or after this whole incident. It's purely the enforcement of law and order. These are people that should be tried openly in civilian court. The court will do what it needs to do, and I applaud the efforts of our civilian criminal system.
Howard,
and I hope that we see all of these guys brought to justice in an open court, and I'm sure that they will be brought to justice.
Howard, want to keep going?
Well, the point is that these terrorists are shooting at our soldiers overseas, and then they're not in uniform anyway. They are illegal combatants. That's what they are. They're illegal combatants there. They're illegal combatants here. So they should not be afforded the same criminal service that our regular common street thug would be afforded. Somebody who robs a 7-Eleven. These are not petty criminals.
Bill,
these are hardened terrorists
one at a time. Bill, go ahead.
I'm not calling them petty criminals. It is clearly a vast enterprise intended to harm the very fundamentals on which our country is founded. But the fact is that they're not organized under any country, under any flag. There is no government to talk to. If these are people who are representing. Even the Taliban, it's a gray area. It's just these are people that are criminals. They're big. They're organized. They're militarized. They're weaponized. All of these things. But and I'm not against the full weight, the full brunt of the federal government going after these guys. Just the fact is that they should be held to accountability in the system that we have established over a period of 200-something
years. This man apparently doesn't know that in World War II, after the war was after we had conquered Germany, people who continued to commit terrorist acts were shot on site and had court martial trials in the field. This is what I equate it to.
Not that you're advocating it.
No, I'm not advocating people get shot on site.
Don't make a right here. I mean,
that's not the point. You don't understand.
One at a time. Bill, get a last word, and then Howard will get a last word.
I have a lot of experience in that part of the world and in this part of the world, and as a person who was directly affected by these acts, I was elated to see this trial happen in Manhattan without even fanfare. I mean, it's like if you ask 1,000 people in downtown Manhattan, is there a terrorist trial going on?
They're
more concerned with the GM public offer.
But, Bill, which we'll talk about in a minute, by the way, but, Bill, there will be fanfare if KSM is tried here, right?
Yeah, I think so, but New Yorkers move on.
And, Howard, do you feel at all queasy about a conviction in a military tribunal in this case being based on evidence obtained through torture?
Well, we don't know that. We just don't know that. It's been bantied about that there's been torture, but...
Well, the judge ruled that, right? He excluded that witness because his identity was obtained through the defendant revealing him under torture or coercive interrogation.
I'll tell you what I feel queasy about, Brian. I feel queasy about cycling hundreds, if not possibly thousands of people through New York City in criminal trials. That is absurd. I can't believe somebody would even propose that.
Howard,
we're picking up hundreds of people on the battlefield all over the world, and we're going to cycle them through New York City or D.C. That's absurd. It's absolutely absurdity. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate you engaging, Howard. Thanks a lot. And Bill, same to you. And we're going to leave it there. Voices of the People on the Gailani verdict and its implications. Thanks to all of you who called. Thanks to our previous guest, Karen Greenberg from NYU. And coming up in a minute, we will do exactly what Bill just referred to, and that is check in on the stock price of the new General Motors about an hour after the market opens. Stay with us.